Welcome to Everything STEAM. I'm your host, Sam Stanford. As a physicist and structural engineer with Jacobs Engineering, I've made many connections with some bright individuals who are either working, studying, or self-taught and passionate about our particular topics of discussion. This episode's title is Straight to the Point. My guest stars and I will be discussing the Cambrian explosion in as much detail as you can get in a podcast. We plan to cover the geologic timescale of this period, the significance, the causalities, and end products through the formation of some of the most bizarre and revolutionary organisms in the fossil record. Then we relax the belt a bit and discuss some of the common occurrences as a paleontologist and what it's like to be at a Cambrian dig site. And finally, we finish out with a perplexing discussion about one of the debate topics that plagues the scientific community, the debate between contingency and determinism as the mainstay driver of our theory of evolution. Now please, let me introduce my guest stars for the show, Brennan Martins and Trevor Rempert. Brennan is a third-year paleontology student at the University of Alberta and the director of the Vancouver Paleontological Society. He studies the lower to middle Cambrian fossils of British Columbia and has been an avid fossil collector since he was 5 years old. Brennan is currently working with the Cranbrook History Center on excavating and studying a lower Cambrian fossil site with rare soft body preservation. Trevor is a master's student at Case Western Reserve University studying medical physiology. Prior to his current education, he received his undergraduate degree at Northwestern University in biomedical engineering. And in addition to studying medicine, Trevor is an avid avocational paleontologist whose hobby has taken him all across the United States in search for fossils. His most recent project involves studying the biodiversity of mosasaurs in the late Cretaceous of Morocco, just prior to the KT extinction. So, now that you've been introduced to my guests and the topic of this podcast, we're going to head into the first segment where we will dive into the Cambrian explosion and geologic time. Brennan, Trevor, welcome to the show. Nice to have you here.
Nice to be back.
Yeah, I'm glad to finally be on one of your episodes.
Yeah. Well, Trevor, I guess I should have started with this, but Trevor was on one of our podcasts. And if you want to learn or just hear more of Trevor, you could go check out Earth's Mass Extinctions. I think that was our 13th episode. So that was about a year ago. I think this is scheduled to be episode 33. I know I'm going to regret saying this, but I think it's episode 33. No, 32. Yes. So Brennan, also, yes, it's very great to have you on the show. Been meaning to get you on the show for a while, so this is wonderful.
Honored. Oh my goodness.
We're also doing your fans some fan service here as well. Happy to have you guys on. Today, more importantly for this first segment, we're going to kind of run like a precursor for the geologic time frame that we want to discuss, also setting up the geologic time frame to where we want to discuss. And then maybe slightly introducing or throwing in some detail about what happened prior to the Cambrian explosion, which, I mean, obviously, if you're here and you're watching and listening, you definitely saw the title. So we're going to talk a little bit about what happened beforehand, precursor that, talk about the Cambrian explosion, and then jump into the next segment. Just before we get into the weeds of things, and I hand it over to Trevor and Brennan to do their expertise, and I just sit here as a layperson, I'm just going to quickly run through the geologic timescale from a 1,000-foot overview. That way, everybody's on the same page. So the Earth is about 4.5 to 4.6 billion years old. We kind of classify things in different time frames. And the biggest one that we use is eons. Am I right by saying that? Eons. Yes. So the first eon is like about a billion years. It's 4.5, 4.6 to about 3.7. That's called the Hadean eon. This is a really chaotic time on Earth. This is the coalescence after the mass disk that we get from after the supernovae event, and you're getting the Earth forming. It's very hot. It's very chaotic. You have bombardments coming in through different space bodies like asteroids, comets, etc. And then over this time period, things start to cool and we get what we call abiogenesis, or the start of life. And this happened around the hydrothermal vents under the Earth's oceans at the time. Now, that's single-celled life. That's not multicellular. Multicellular doesn't come in for like a really long time. So it's about roughly 600 million years ago. So you have 4.6 to about 600 million years let's just say 4 billion years it took to get multicellular life. That's where we are. And if you want to break that time frame up, there's two eons. We can go with the Archean eon and the Proterozoic eon. So that's a really big time frame. And what we're talking about here, the precursor in terms of periods, if you look at the Proterozoic, it's about like what? Not even 100 million years. It's not much. So I'm going to hand it off. That's what I can give you on the 1,000-foot overview. Trevor, would you like to talk about on the period scale, the Ediacaran?
Yeah. Okay. So like you were saying, Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and the first 4 billion years of which is called the Precambrian. Pre means before. So this is the time before the Cambrian. Cambrian is what we're talking about today. And during the Precambrian, life was very simple. It existed as single-celled bacteria and plankton, and multicellular life doesn't appear until very end of the Precambrian, very end of the first 4 billion years of life on Earth. And the Precambrian consists of 90% of Earth's history. This is a massive amount of time, and the period that follows it, the Cambrian, is tiny by comparison. It's only 50 million years. This small period of time, though, the Cambrian, is regarded as one of the most important in Earth's history. And it's because during this period of time, life goes through an explosion in diversity and radiation of form and body plan. You have small, simple organisms with very simple body plans that diversify into every major body plan that's living today, almost, all within a short period of about 20 million years, the first part of the Cambrian. So the Ediacaran, like was prefaced, is the period that is immediately prior to the Cambrian. And during the Ediacaran and some of the preceding times, the continents were arranged into a supercontinent. Supercontinents produce very strange weather patterns, and it makes it so that life on Earth can have a very hard time. So during the period immediately preceding the Ediacaran, there's a series of snowball Earth events where glacial ice flows all the way down to the equator, and nearly the entirety of Earth is covered in ice. Life is reduced to surviving in only the small spots where light can penetrate through the ice and near hydrothermal vents deep under the water. It's in the breakup of the supercontinent that we start to have global warming and the emergence of shallow seas. And that's where the first complex multicellular organisms start to appear. And these are called the Ediacarans, the predecessors to the Cambrians.
Gotcha. Oh, by the way, I just wanted to throw in there that is the cryogenian glaciation, that period of time. Yeah. If anybody wanted to look that up, they have a name for it. And that is a really weird time. A snowball Earth, that's just so weird. You don't even like, that's something out of like a sci-fi novel, but it's something that can happen and has happened multiple times, which is crazy.
In that cryogenian period, it froze and unfroze and froze again and then unfroze again. We're talking frozen like Star Wars Hoth, where just holding a giant ball of ice.
Very alien looking. Yeah. And the organisms during this time, as they're getting more complex, they're taking on these forms that are very reminiscent of modern day rugs and air mattresses. So they're these sessile creatures. They don't have any eyes, or most of them don't have means of mobility. They're just sitting on the bottom filter feeding. We also see jellies appear and sea pen like organisms. So they got all the little bristles along their body. They're anchored into the seafloor, the sediment, and they're filter feeding with all these little finger-like projections from their bodies.
Interesting. So, Brennan, do you think that it's not only just a lack of oxygen that made mobility kind of not really a thing during that time period? Was it also just a lack of like really vital nutrients? Or were the nutrients there and it was just a lack of oxygen?
Oh, yeah. There was plenty of nutrients for these organisms. They just didn't need to get around to find the nutrients. It was so abundant that the ability to kind of suck a place dry of its natural resources wasn't really that big of a worry for these guys. So they needed to just stay where they are. They had plenty of microbial mat to feed on. That's why a lot of them were sessile. Yeah. No really need to go find out a new greater amount of food somewhere else.
Talking about microbial mat, to give a little background, there was very little complex life on Earth at this time. So just the whole of the seafloor would be covered with different sorts of bacteria and other microbes. And they're just living along the floor of the ocean, just in a thick layer of like mucus, just all along the surface of the seafloor.
Interesting. They were just on the top. There was no like subsurface microbial life.
Just,
it was all
just on the top. And then wild. The Ediacaran organisms, which are those very simple like tube and frond shaped creatures, they would just kind of move along the surface of it, just eating the microbes that where they were implanted into the ground, but not deep. They're just sessile. So they're planted into the ground and filter feeding.
Wow.
They're very simple body plans, simple organisms.
It's such a cool tale too. Like a snowball Earth event created this type of complex, in a sense, not as complex as we'd like to say, life that then led to such an immense explosion. I find it that there may be also the case of this snowball Earth with this glaciation retreating, like what you would normally think, this grinding effect of the sediments on top of the land surface, creating an abundance of extra nutrients in the oceans. So maybe that was also a large contributor on top of the influx in oxygen. Do you know how this influx in oxygen occurred?
It makes sense that the ice receding allows more light into the ocean for these algae colonies to produce more oxygen, especially in the microbial mat as well. You get greater amounts of diversity as there's more algae. It's at the bottom of the food chain, like modern day grass, right? And so all these bacteria are feeding on these colonies and they're becoming more diverse. And then these are being eaten by the rather more complex biota of the time, the Ediacarans. So that probably contributed to a lot of the higher levels of oxygen in the water. That's what I'm going off of.
What was it? Like 3.7 billion years ago. That's when cyanobacteria first evolved. They're the photosynthetic ones that they take energy from the light of the sun and use it to produce oxygen. This very gradually builds up into appreciable levels of oxygen in the ocean. This is a process that takes billions and billions of years. And it's only from that 3.7 billion years ago up to that around 600 million years ago that there's such an appreciable level of oxygen in the oceans and atmosphere that it can start to be used by organisms for like creation of complex body parts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Two notes to that. First of all, they don't really care to produce oxygen for us. Cyanobacteria is still around today. They could give, excuse my French, they could give two shits about giving you oxygen, but they do. And that's just a byproduct of them trying to do or try to produce what, ATP. So that's their main focus. But like, then there's like, here's all this oxygen for you. The second one is that there's like a really interesting, maybe parallel to like present day to what was around at that time, is that these microbial mats, they're not like at the bottom of the Mariana Trench. Like it would be more like the shallow seas, kind of like representing a coral reef, you know, where you have all these organisms kind of in and around these microbial mats, just like how you would have in a coral reef today. Maybe that's a good parallel for people that are watching and listening can kind of like grasp onto. So yeah. Do we want to talk any more before we head into commercial break, or do we want to just hit like a quick synopsis and then let's beat the cart and go?
I feel like we wrapped up pretty good.
Sweet. Okay. So quick synopsis again, geologic time. There's three eons before where we get to where we want to talk about with the Cambrian explosion, the Hadean, the Archean, and the Proterozoic. That's all Precambrian. So that's a really long time. That's like 4 billion years of time. That's inconceivable to the layperson. But it's really interesting how long single-celled life was around and then turned into multicellular life almost like that. Beautiful sequence. The Ediacaran was the precursor period to the Cambrian period. Both put together about like what 100 to 120 million years. Both are about 60 million years. I'm just going to throw rough bald numbers out there. Sorry, I'm an engineer. But it's a really, really small time in the geologic timescale, but it is so crucial and so wild. It has brought some really interesting features that are still being, that are like the precursor to what is here today. It's what was the attributes that were brought on then are here now, and we can see that. And I can't wait to get into that. So when we come back from this commercial break, we're going to talk about more of the hows and why to where we got to the Cambrian explosion. And then we're going to talk a little bit more about what those niches are. So stick around.
Are you an athlete who is constantly on the grind? Maybe you're a student who's cramming for an 8 a.m. exam the next day. Or maybe you're someone who's crushing a hike and you have three peaks to go. Well, you've come to the right ad. Sigma snacks are a healthy alternative to pre-workout and energy drinks. These snacks deliver easily digestible sugars and carbs necessary to crush an early morning workout, late night study sesh, or any adventure in between. By combining caffeine and the amino acid L-theanine, these bars are backed by scientific research to provide clean energy, extra focus, and reduce the anxiety and crash that are associated with normal pre-workout and junk energy drinks. Not to mention, they taste great. Specifically, I have been taking them with me on my backpacking adventures. They're a great way to start the day without having any jitters or an upset stomach on the trail. Lastly, Sigma Snacks is a student-run, student-operated startup that would like to offer you 15% off your first purchase with the promo code STEAM. So head on over to eatsigmasnacks.com and order your first Sigma Snack today to have the best and most reliable source of energy shipped right to your door. That's eatsigmasnacks.com, promo code STEAM for energy that's out of this world.
We're back from commercial break, and this is segment two. Like I said before we went into commercial, this is going to be primarily about why and how the Cambrian explosion happened. And then also, we're going to get into some of the organisms and the niches that are within the Cambrian explosion. Pretty wild. I'm excited for it. I'm going to hand it off to Trevor. He's going to run through some of the things that have been shown that have possibly caused and or have worked together to cause the Cambrian explosion. So, Trevor, you got the floor, man.
The Cambrian was a time of evolutionary experimentation, and that's where we start to see the first appearance of calcified hard parts, flexible limbs and eyes, predation and defense. And this is different from the Ediacaran period that we were just talking about, because this is where you start to see very complex body forms start to appear. The Ediacaran ends with the destruction of the microbial mats, because in the fossil record, what you can slowly see is these mats of bacteria slowly get worn away by little worms and all these burrowing creatures. And that's the boundary for what makes Ediacaran versus Cambrian.
And we get all these hard parts suddenly appearing due to a shift in minerals within the water. So the receding ice sheets bring forth all this dissolved rock and broken up bits of sand, which delivers high amounts of different minerals into the water, where these organisms can then extract it and use it for building upon these hard parts like eye lenses or armor plating or spines or jaws. So that was definitely a big help in developing those kind of hard parts.
Interesting. Brennan, I don't mean to jump back on you, but whenever Trevor was talking about these microbial mats disappearing because of burrowing organisms, two things kind of come to my mind. One, were they devouring these microbial mats in also cadence with, since they're burrowing, they're obviously kicking up an immense amount of sediment. Is that sediment then just kind of, it's a doubling effect, like they could possibly be devouring them, but also, you know, blocking the sun from getting to their mats. Like it's probably a doubling effect.
So some of it is, yes, they're eating a little bit of the microbial mat. Most of it is just the fact that they're burrowing, they're loosening up sediment, and they're just destroying the soft substrate that they're living on, that the microbial mat was living on. Mm-hmm. And when those mats get destroyed, that's where you see all the Ediacaran organisms, which is the sessile ones, and then the ones that just kind of crawl along the seafloor, they all just go extinct. And their extinction, though, paves the way for all the complex and bizarre creatures of the Cambrian.
That's a good point. And jumping back to, like, whenever we met last for the Earth's mass extinctions, that's something that we made extremely prevalent, that, like, whenever there was a mass extinction event, and even, like, smaller extinction events, like the Ediacaran, they bring forth the ability to have different niches emerge, which is super exciting. So this is exactly what it is, but on a crazy scale.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. It is mind-blowing, the amount of niches that came out of this.
Important to any discussion is what causes things. So what caused the Cambrian explosion? We think that there's a few factors, and these things were all happening at around the same time. Increase in oxygen level allows for more complex organisms to evolve. It allows for metabolic processes to be conducted more efficiently. They can produce better proteins and more proteins. And that's where you start getting all these weird and bizarre and wonderful body parts. You start to have increased ozone layer formation, and increased ozone layer will help shield against UV radiation from the sun. Can't have the Earth constantly being irradiated. It's not good for life.
Not at all.
Yeah. The receding of the glaciers that were at the beginning of the Ediacaran, as those continue to recede, you get more and more minerals that are kicked into the ocean, and you also have more shallow seas that are produced, which is ideal environment for life to start going through all these different evolutionary trials. Warming environment paired with glaciation. You can't be frozen ocean. And evolution of eyes, and this kind of pairs with evolutionary arms race that maybe Brennan wants to talk about, how there's a series of predator-prey relationships that form. Brennan, did you want to take this?
Sure, for sure. So eyes are a pivotal moment in time when you get this new sense adapted to your body. Most of the organisms before relied on feeling and touch, and maybe even sensing chemical changes in the water. But now we get the first appearance of visual cues. These organisms can sense shadows above them. They've got these little pineals on the top of the head where they can sense this change in light. So when it's dark or when it's sunny, right? And that's why living in these shallow environments really helps. They have direct contact with the sun so that they can know if there's shadows above them or not. They can tell the difference between the two, right? Here's where they take it a step forward. During the Cambrian period, with all this minerals in the water, trilobites, they took advantage of this beyond all other arthropods, not only for their armored bodies, but for their eyes. So they were able to coat their sensory organs, their visual sensory organs, in a layer of calcite, this crystalline structure on top of that, to allow them to see greater amounts of detail besides just shadows. And this was one of the first complex visual systems, one of the complex eyes that you can see in the fossil record. We don't know of anything else appearing earlier, but this is the earliest eye that we have. So that's kind of how they adapted that. And then slowly throughout the Cambrian, other organisms evolved these lenses and eye caps in all sorts of different groups, not just arthropods.
Okay, so we've talked about what has caused the Cambrian explosion on, like, a really good surface level, just so, you know, the layperson can understand. The next portion that we wanted to cover was these sites, these major Cambrian sites. So, Brennan, do you have some insight on where these sites are and how, like, important they were?
For sure. So stepping back into the future, or I guess the present, we now get to see these fossil sites. Now, these are some of my favorite aspects of the field, because you get to actually go out and find these organisms. But Cambrian sites are a little bit rare. You got to understand that the Earth is constantly moving. Tectonic plates are shifting and recycling. So a lot of fossil sites and a lot of these layers of rock are lost forever. They're destroyed. They're weathered away. So fossil sites in general are quite rare in comparison to their original yield, right? So there's little spots around the world. the major areas of Cambrian rock are exposed in China, North America, and Australia, and very, very few have soft-bodied material. Trilobites are some of the most common fossils from all these sites because they have a different body structure than most of the organisms of the Cambrian. They've got calcitic bodies, so their armor is able to withstand a lot of the fossilization process. So bacteria that would eat away at most soft parts would not be able to eat that big chunky armor there, right? So trilobites are very common. Most, if not all, Cambrian sites have them, but it's the soft-bodied organisms that dominate the Cambrian besides the trilobites that we don't see a lot of in most Cambrian fossil sites. That's because the sand needs to be very fine to preserve these details, and these organisms need to die in an environment where there's little oxygen, so bacteria can't eat away at their soft parts. So that's why there's very few sites where we can find soft preservation. One of the most notable is here in Canada, where I live, the Burgess Shale, which is in the Rocky Mountains, Yoho National Park. So that's on the border of British Columbia and Alberta. It's high up in the mountains. This layer has been pushed up from tectonic activity and mountain building to be at this high elevation. But this is one of the most famous fossil sites because this preservation of soft-bodied organisms is beyond anything we've ever seen. This is a very rare event where these organisms were living on the bottom of a sea cliff. And during the Cambrian period, there's no coral. So corals make up a lot of structure on sea cliffs, and they prevent the mud and sediment and sand from falling off the sea cliffs during events like earthquakes, right? So we've got no structure to the sediment. So every time some natural disaster happens, all the sediment from the top of this sea cliff would fall off down onto the seafloor below. And all these communities of sponges and worms and arthropods would be instantly buried. There's no chance for bacteria to eat away at them. And this fine sediment preserves them perfectly. So this rare event in time has been captured in a layer of rock that is also a rare occurrence to be preserved in time. So it's like winning the lottery, this fossil site. And there's other occurrences of soft body preservation. There's the Shengzheng in China, which is very similar to the Burgess Shale. We see these soft bodied organisms. They preferably fell into a more anoxic environment, so low oxygen levels, where they could also have their organs and tissues preserved as well. And there's more common fossil sites down in the United States. We see in Utah, it is like trilobite heaven. There are so many trilobite beds down there. If you're a fossil collector watching this, you've heard of all of those localities. But the Utah fossil sites take place a little bit after the Burgess Shale. The Burgess Shale is 508 million years old, if I can recall. And the ones in Utah are a little bit younger, yes. And the site in China, the Shengzheng, takes place before the Burgess Shale. So we see a little bit of overlap of species, as well as some older species that went extinct or might be just regional variation. There's a really cool fossil site in British Columbia. It's near the Burgess Shale. It's in a little town called Cranbrook, and it has some very nice soft-bodied preservation, almost similar to the Burgess Shale. That's a site that I work on. Most of my research takes place in that locality. So you'll hear me ramble about that at the end, but that's another great place to find Cambrian rock. So we've got it scattered here and there across the globe, little sites.
So my understanding to this is that there are at least two ways that you can get soft body preservation. It's these natural occurrences of like these one-off events where you have earthquakes or whatever that create this immediate burial of these organisms, stationary and mobile. Now, one that kind of makes me go aha a little bit is these deoxygenized areas where it doesn't have enough dissolved oxygen in an area. And that makes me think that that's more of a site where you would see immobile, maybe like your sponges, rather than mobile, because deoxygenized areas don't typically like happen that fast. And my thought process to that would be, because of the breakup of Pannotia, you're having different circulations of sea current. So that's where you end up getting these areas that had sponges at one time, but then ended up dying out because there was just a lack of dissolved oxygen being spread from the changing of the oceanic currents. And maybe there's more to it. Do you have anything to add to that? I'm not sure. Maybe.
That is perfect. That is perfect. A lot of these Cambrian sites, like in Utah, where you see the trilobites, you also get a lot of algae and sponges, right? So a lot of them are either being pushed into a more anoxic environment, or they're being stuck in an area that becomes anoxic. So that's a great way for fossils to preserve, especially like the mobile and immobile organisms.
Oh, good point. Yeah. Not even just the currents, it's also pooling where you have differences. Yeah, they end up getting segregated from other bodies of water. Oh, nice. Yeah. So that's where you can trap the mobile organisms.
Exactly. Like in shallow waters too. Yeah.
You know, we're not out here being tetrapods for another couple hundred million years. So,
yeah.
But yeah. Okay. That's really cool. Do you have anything else to add, Trevor, or do we want to jump into, I know we just kind of threw a bunch on to Brennan. He went for like a rant there for a little bit.
Yeah. But
so do you want to preface the Cambrian organisms, Trevor? And then Brennan, we can let you go to town because that's your wheelhouse, man.
For sure.
Sure. Okay. There's many different bizarre and weird looking organisms that appear very quickly in the fossil record. You get groups like the arthropods, which are the ancestors of many modern day insect groups. You get the chordates, the ancestors of anything that's got a vertebra. Mm-hmm. Brachiopods appear, sponges, worms, mollusks, and echinoderms. I think, Brennan, you get to explain them all.
Oh, man, how exciting. Yeah, no, it is insane how many of these phylums appear during this time. Just the radiation of diversity. And all of these major groups lead into what we see today. All of them. They all start here, right? So there's so many bizarre organisms. I mean, every single Cambrian organism, maybe not the algae, kind of represents what we see today, but the rest of them, they're so diverse, and it's such a niche area to look into. It's hard to know all of these bizarre forms, but I'm going to try and crunch as many cool ones, all of my favorites and maybe some fan favorites as well, into this segment. So forgive me if I go a bit too fast. I'll try and slow down on the descriptions for sure. But we'll start off with arthropods. So these guys led into our modern day crabs, crustaceans, insects, stuff like that. But during this time, they were some of the largest predators in the ocean, and they dominated the seafloor and below the seafloor, as well as the ocean itself. So they took every niche they could and ran with it. Going with the largest predators, most of them were within the group Dinocharids. Terrible claws. Dinosaur means terrible lizard. Dinocharid means terrible claw. And these guys live up to their name. They've got these big, massive claws you see behind me here. For those on video, Nomlacharis, this was one of the largest predators of the Burgess Shale and the Cambrian period. And they had a claw kind of reminiscent of a shrimp body. So when this fossil was first discovered, it was detached from the head. And it was originally thought to be the body of a shrimp, but we now know it connects to a much larger organism. So Anomalocaris had complex eyes, very similar to modern day dragonflies. So they could see the world around them in a more binocular view. They also came equipped with a very large mouth at the bottom of the head, kind of like a jellyfish shape. Again, another fossil we misidentified in the early ages. The mouth can detach from the head just like the claws. So a lot of these organisms, when they die, their bodies fall apart and you find these separate pieces of body. And since most Cambrian creatures are so bizarre, it's hard to determine what they are. It was assumed that these body parts were separate organisms, but they all connect to one big guy. They also have these dorsal plates that they use for motion. So they also breathe with them. Their gills line the underside of these plates that line the body, and they paddle them up and down to swim. Nomlacharis also had these tail fans on the back for steering, similar to a boat. So it would have been a predator that would have taken advantage of its mobility. It could have swam after prey and attacked them, or fed on the bottom on rather immobile prey. It has been found to eat soft-bodied organisms and trilobites, so it wasn't too picky with its meals.
Did they last through the Cambrian, or is that something that kind of fell off?
It's a sad story. They fell off hard. So after the Cambrian period, these guys became filter-feeding whales, basically, in their environment. They went from being the top predator to some oversized vacuum cleaner for plankton, right? And there's nothing wrong with that, but they lost their status at top of the food chain. And then eventually after that, they got completely replaced by other organisms, mostly fish and sea scorpions and cephalopods.
They remind me of a Swiss Army knife, or like the quote unquote jack of all trades, master of nothing.
Exactly. That mouth can pop open a trilobite. Those claws can grab anything. It was a crazy, apex predator. Absolutely crazy.
The first apex predator.
The first apex predator. There you go. Good point. We're diving right into another fan favorite. This one's a personal favorite of mine, Opabinia. So this guy, again, I've got a little stuffy of it. It had some of the most bizarre features of any Cambrian organism. It was an absolute oddball, and most people love it for them. So it had five eyes on its head, one of which is at the top, two on the sides, two on the front. So the eyes on the front are similar to a predator's eyes, right? Forward facing, it can see what it's chasing down, kind of like a bird of prey, right? And the two on the sides are for detecting predators or competition coming from the side. So this guy was tiny. Keep in mind, most vergashale organisms are a couple millimeters long. So this guy was about 100 millimeters long. Very, very small. So it would have had to keep a lookout for larger predators like Anomalocaris. Hence why it also has an eye on the top of its head where it can sense the shadows above it and dart for cover, right? So all of these eyes played a role in its protection or feeding. Also, its head was fixed to its body, so it could not look around. So those helped it out a lot.
You just like casually said that that's only 100 millimeters long. My ape brain was like, dude, these things are massive. I thought they were like bigger than that. No, they're that small.
They're tiny. 90% of the Burgashale's fauna is a couple millimeters in length. They are small as heck.
Yeah. Okay, I guess that makes sense because there wasn't still that much like oxygen floating around. Okay, so let me pull myself back and get scientific. I was like, I'm thinking like these things are, you know, a decent size, you know, but no.
Yeah, around the size of a cat, right? It's like a meter long. Okay, so it's huge. compared to everything else.
Filter feeders that it evolved into got a little bit larger.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I guess we didn't establish a sense of scale. It's kind of hard. Of course, you know, you pull out like a stuffed organism here, and I'm like, oh, it's about that big. Cool. And you're like, yeah, it's 100 millimeters. Oh, that's small.
Kind of a letdown. Yeah.
Darn. No, I'm sorry. Continue.
No worries. Yeah, the other type of bizarre adaptation is this weird trunk, kind of like an elephant's trunk, but it ends in a set of jaws. So it has these projections from the jaws that are kind of like teeth. They're these little barbs that can clamp onto soft organisms swimming in the water, and it can use its trunk to move the food to the bottom of the mouth. So underneath, kind of like Anomalocaris, it has this little round mouth where it can suck in food. How is it going to get that food to the mouth? It's got a handy little trunk. So that was its major adaptation. And unfortunately, after the Cambrian period, we don't see anything like it appear ever again. It is lost to time. And it's pretty sad because this guy is an absolutely adorable little critter, right?
I know bilateral symmetry is so important, but what if we had five eyes? Man. Just spitballing here.
Awesome. It's not too far off. Spiders have eight eyes, right? So we still kind of have a few things with them.
That's fair. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Lizards and snakes, they also have like a third eye, right? Or a pineal organ.
It's a little scale at the top of their head that can detect light. I wouldn't call it an eye.
Hey, but that's on the level of Cambrian.
Pretty cool adaptation, if you ask me. It'd be kind of like us having a freckle right here that would help us out.
Oh man, that would be sick. Okay, another cool thing to have, a shell on our back. So a lot of these early arthropods, they kind of stole clams and mollusks' thought process. They're like, hey, what if we develop a kind of bivalve shell on our back for protection? So a lot of the groups during the Cambrian started having this kind of heart-shaped piece of armor fully connected to their back for protection. And a lot of these guys, they're called the phylacarids, kind of like a helmet mixed with a turtle shell, right? So these critters could hide within this sheet of armor from larger creatures, but a lot of them were not really predators. They would swim around in the water column going after algae. They'd crawl on the bottom looking for worms or decaying matter, and they'd use these armored shells for protection. So one of my favorite is Tazoia, this boxy arthropod in a shell that kind of resembles alligator skin. So it's got this crisscross honeycomb scaling on the shell, which would have helped the shell withstand pressure. So the honeycomb pattern was like a structural support to these crushing organisms like anomalocaris. So that was its major innovation to defend against predation. It also had spines. A lot of phylacarids just had plain smooth shells. Tazoia took it a step further and added little spikes. They may have been for decoration, but most likely for warding off these predators. Hey, don't attack me. I've got spines, right? So they were very common during the Cambrian. You can find them in lots of fossil sites as well, as their carapace did preserve quite well. Another arthropod, one of the most famous and most common of this time, trilobites. They got so diverse so fast compared to every other Cambrian arthropod. And that was partially due to their stronger armor. Right. Yeah. Well, they were an army. They were in the mass. They bred like crazy. The amount of eggs they laid was immense. And it also helped out to a lot of the mutations that led to new body plans and new armor and spines and stuff. But trilobites definitely dominated the ocean floor. They took niches of eating algae, being the main food source for a lot of these bigger animals, as well as being predators to smaller organisms like worms. So they would kind of crawl under the sediment into burrows and grab these worms, these smaller worms, right? And they were also able to swim as well for the most part. And they had these whip-like tentacles on their heads that they could use to feel the world around them. Some had a pair on their booty, which is called a patigium. That's the final segment on the body. So trilobites get their name, trilobite, three segments. So the head, the cephalon, the body, and then the patigium, the butt end. All trilobites had those for the most part.
Wasn't there like 20-some thousand species
listed? Absolutely. It's insane. Yeah. that's through the whole, after the Cambrian and beyond to the Permian. That is just the immense amount of diversity. They kind of fell off in the last two time period, the Carboniferous and the Permian, but they were definitely really diverse end of Cambrian throughout the Silurian and Ordovician. That's when they got all the crazy headgear, right? The big spines and the curly spikes and stuff. But in the Cambrian, they were relatively simple.
That's like, what, 200 some million years, though? Like, that's accomplishments.
Yeah.
20 some thousand species, 200 million years. Man.
Yeah, you compare it to T-Rex. T-Rex only been around for 2 million years, right? Yeah. The trilobites.
Only a couple hundred thousand years. Humans.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I forget about the humans. Yeah. relatively like insignificant in the grand scheme of things. So trilobites took on those weird forms. There's tiny blind ones. So they didn't need the light at all. They lived in deeper, darker waters. So they'd feed on anything that fell into the darker waters and was decaying. So they were the bottom feeders, right? If you find those tiny trilobites, the blind ones, you know that the environment was a lot deeper, deep water, because you'd see more of the tiny trilobites and less algae or large predators, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's some other odd arthropods that I'm quickly going to go on to. There's a group called Leoncolia. So it's similar to a trilobite. It's got an armored body, but it has these whips, these tentacles that stick out the front of its body, a bunch of them. And it did not have eyes. it would have used these whip-like tentacles to feel the sediment and dig for small organisms like worms. These whip-like tentacles were its major advantage in rummaging through the sediment to look for other organisms to eat.
Think like a mantis shrimp for Leontolia. Yeah,
that's a exactly.
Great comparison.
Mantis shrimp for sure. And moving on to worms. So they're eating these worms, right? Worms weren't at the bottom of the food chain. Okay. Worms were some of the most crazy organisms at this time for their size. So think of Dune, the giant sandworms from Dune. So these little organisms in the Cambrian are going about their life on the seafloor, and suddenly the sediment opens up below them, and this massive beast of a worm comes out with a vacuum-like head, and it sucks everything up around it, including all these little organisms, right? So these worms were massive. Some of them could reach around a meter in length, and they would live under the substrate, waiting for their chance to strike at anything that passes above them. And they were fierce looking. They had spikes that rimmed their head just in case any large predator wants to take a bite out of them. So they were fully protected against anything larger, but they were definitely the top of the food chain when it came to the sediment livers, right?
Brennan, where are you getting these pillows? I'm just.
Oh my god, I have my sources. Yeah, there's Etsy, there's eBay. Lots of niche shellers have these crazy things.
That's wild. You're just pulling out all of these plushes of different campaigns. Yeah,
I made sure to come prepared, that's for sure.
That's awesome.
Yeah, no, lots of diversity in them. So a lot of the worms fossilize with their gut contents, so we can get a sense of what they're eating. Oh, there's little trilobites in there. There's little cone shells. There's little arthropod body parts. That's a great thing about the Cambrian critters, is when they get preserved, you can see everything inside of them if they're preserved right. It really helps us understand the nervous systems and early gut tracts of these organisms, and basically where our internal body systems came from, right? So these big predatory worms, they were patrolling the seafloor, but we also get a smaller group of worms that took their body plan a step further and evolved multiple sets of legs. So lobopods are the legged worms, and these guys would have used these multiple pairs of legs, kind of like a caterpillar, to hook onto, say, sponges and feed on them, or use the sponges as an anchor to grab particles out of the water. One of the most famous worms of the Burgershale, or lobopods rather, is Hallucigenia. So when this guy was discovered, they believed that they were hallucinating when they saw it. They've got this weird worm with spines on its back and all these little legs dangling off of it, right? So originally, though, this guy was thought to be upside down. He would have walked on these spines, kind of like stilts on the sediment, and had all these fleshy limbs to grab food out of the water column. But we now know the limbs were for the walking and the spines were for protection, right? This fossil usually preserved with this big black blob on one side of it. And it was originally interpreted to be a head. So it would have had this large bulbous head, right? That's what they were thinking. Later studies show these blobs that formed at the end of the fossils were actually the gut contents being forced out of the creature and preserved alongside of it. So this bulby head was not a part of the worm. It actually had a very long neck with a small head at the end of it, with two little eye spots too. So this guy looked adorable. If anyone gets a chance, look up Hallucigenia. It is a cute little organism. The reconstructions are adorable. The figures don't do justice. But yeah, they were dwelling around. I'm sad they're not around today. The closest thing we have are velvet worms, which are now terrestrial, and they squirt a type of goo on their predator or prey item to catch it, right? We don't know if the Cambrian variety did that.
Wow. That's super interesting. Yeah. How there was that many types of worms, but they were so spread out. Whenever you say worms, you don't think of worms that have spikes and limbs.
Exactly. There's swimming worms too. So bristle worms, these guys had hairs, kind of like a mammal hair, that would coat their limbs, and they would use that to swim through the water column. So they were completely mobile, out of the substrate, right? They took over all niches as well. which is pretty wicked.
Interesting.
Going to a little bit less interesting topic, sponges. So sponges are still around today in their basic forms. We view them as kind of like a prehistoric animal because they don't move around. They filter feed. They pump water through their body, and they're full of these holes. So when the water goes into the body cavity through a massive hole at the top, it is pumped out the sides. And when it's pumped out these little holes, they have cilia, these little tailed cells that collect food particles, and that's how they eat. So they're a big colony of microorganisms, right? They were the primary reef builders at the time. We didn't have any corals or polyps or stuff like that. So a lot of the seafloor, whenever there's a cluster of shells or rocks, sponges would anchor and form this kind of community that would make up what we'd see as today would be coral reefs, right? So all these organisms would live in and amongst the sponges and the algae of the time. And we get tall varieties. There's Leptomitis, which is like a meter long, the tallest sponge of the Burgess Shale. They were like skyscrapers. And we had sponges that would protect themselves from these worms. So like there's a type of worm called Ischia. It had basically kind of like Hallucigenia without spikes. It had these big, strong legs to cling on to these sponges. And it had these two pairs of limbs, kind of like arms, that had spines on it. And it would use that to tear up the sponge and force it into this round mouth at the front of the head. And sponges, they're sessile. They stand there and do nothing. So a lot of them evolved massive spines, kind of like a porcupine, to kind of deter these lobopods from feeding on them. So sponges were also getting in on the spiny action as well.
Interesting. This is just a random off topic, maybe, well, it's on topic question. So there's a lot of defense mechanisms that are being brought up. Is there any like chemical defense mechanisms, like where an organism creates some sort of chemical that like wards off prey? Is that something that happens maybe further down the line?
We actually have no clue. This is something that doesn't preserve in the fossil record. We don't have any traces of these chemicals that would have worn off predator or prey, but we can assume that they most likely had it, as a lot of modern day relatives, these more simple forms, have it. So it wouldn't be too far off that these creatures were using these unseen sort of mechanisms for defense, right? But we don't get it fossilized, so it's hard to say.
Also, I might want to maybe just preface this for later. I'm not sure if we're going to get into this. I think we are. Is that you've kind of made this claim a couple times now that like this, like sponges are still alive and thriving today, whereas some other beings fell off or fell short. And a lot of people go, aha, you know, evolution isn't real, you know, because these things, you know, die off or they're still here today. They didn't evolve. That's not the case. They do evolve. They do bring in new species and new things, but there's also like a speed variation to evolution. And it's a lot of the times brought about with niching and environmental pressures. Also, it has to do with genetic randomness. There's a lot at play. You can't just make something extremely binary like that. So a lot of these sponges have filled a niche, and there's not extreme environmental pressures that are pushing it to have mutations that take different forms.
Yeah, we don't see a lot of change in them because there's not really anything trying to take their place in the environment, right? Yeah. There's nothing like sponges that can take a sponge's place, besides coral, of course. But sponges are deep water, coral are shallow water, right? So they kind of found their two little balance. Yeah,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I figured we were going to talk about that later, but I just wanted to emphasize and also preface our talk for later.
Before you like forget, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You want to talk about mollusks now? I think that's the next thing that we wanted to touch on.
Yeah, mollusks were kind of interesting during this time because a lot of them took a similar shape to what we'd probably see today. So there is a group called hyoliths. So they're cone-shelled bottom dwellers. Let me just grab this guy. So they're kind of like an ice cream cone on their side, right? So these guys would have had a slug-like organism living in this shell, slowly cruising along the bottom looking for food. But they were tiny. They're like 10 millimeters long, like absolutely minuscule. these guys had an interesting defense mechanism. They had these spines. They're a little floppy on here, but these spines that stick out the sides of where the animal would leave the shell, right? So they had these backward-facing barbs that would help them stay out of other organisms' digestive tracts when they were getting eaten or swallowed by worms or other arthropods. These spines that hook backwards would get stuck on the mouths, so the shell couldn't be sucked up, right? That was their little defense mechanism. They also had a hood that they could close their shell so that things couldn't suck them out of it. So they're perfectly armored in this little cocoon of a body, right? And they would later give rise to snails and squid and octopus and whatnot. But at this time, they're minuscule little cone dwellers. We also see a very early relative of squid appear. So this guy is called Nectocharis, and it had two tentacles. It looked exactly like a squid. It's got its body, it's got the fleshy fins on the two sides. It even has this jet propulsion system where it could suck up water and shoot it out of a jet to go really fast to escape prey. But it only had two tentacles, and of course those tentacles most likely were used to grab prey out of the water and eat them. And it may have had these two eyes on the sides of the head for detecting other larger predators. So we see early squid appear at this time too, not just snails. And there's a very interesting unranked clade called Wawaxia. So this one's another fan favorite. If you guys, lovers of the Burgess Shale, you would know this guy for sure. It is a armored sea slug completely covered in scales. So the whole body had these reptile-like scales coating it, except for the bottom. And it has this little mouth that it would use to kind of rasp up algae and microorganisms or decaying bodies from the seafloor and the sediment, right? But they also were adorned with these massive spikes, about seven on each side. And these spines would have been to deter large predators like Anomalocaris, hence why they're facing upwards. And some people believe it may have been able to shoot them out and regrow them. There's nothing to prove that, but they were definitely a really cool organism that we don't really see much alive today like it.
It's like a porcupine.
Yeah, like a porcupine, exactly.
They're just out there trying to make it even cooler than what it already is. Like, oh, yeah. I can shoot it like quills.
Exactly. No, awesome. They're testing out all these niches. We don't see them around today because other organisms found a better way of doing things and outcompeted them for their food source, right? So This guy would have been really slow, and his way of feeding was definitely really slow. His armor would have slowed it down. That's why we don't see anything like it in later time periods. We see more mobile bottom feeders.
We tried. We failed.
That really is it. Oh, poor guys. That's an unfortunate fate of most Cambrian organisms, but at a time of experimentation, not a time of lasting.
Absolutely.
This brings us to our very important phylum, the chordates. So these guys had a little rod going down their back, a notochord, which would eventually develop into backbones. And they would have had this fleshy muscle blocks called myomeres running along the body. And they would have used that to propel themselves through the water. That's that fish-like movement, right? So we get to see a very bizarre creature called Pacaya. It almost resembles an eel in shape, or maybe a tadpole or a lamprey. Mm-hmm. It has this kind of fleshy fin that runs the length of its back and the dorsal part of its body. It has these two antennae on the top of the head for sensing stuff, and it would have fed with bristles, kind of like a toothbrush, on its mouth. So this fine comb for filtering sediments as well as small microorganisms out of the water column. And it may have had two very simple eyes.
Interesting.
It's kind of bug-like, but it does have the notochord and the muscle blocks. In other fossil sites like China, we see a more developed fish-like appearance, like a Hycoichthys, which has a kind of dorsal fin now, as well as a more defined tail fin. It would have had gill slits running along the neck, and more developed eyes, right? Now, these organisms didn't have jaws or bones. They would have just had an open hole mouth for sucking, hence why they needed that filter feeding system on the front. But these would have given rise to the fish that you'd see in later time periods, and then eventually everything.
It's a good point. Jaws don't come around till in the Silurian, or is it even closer to
lower Ordovician? Well, Ordovician is when we get those armored fishes that they really dominated, but between the Ordovician and Devonian,
because
you get like early sharks and stuff, right?
Yeah, good point. The good point. Yeah. There's too much to remember, and I am not in this field. Apologies. Yeah.
No worries. It is so much to take in. It's like every group at once, where most people study like dinosaurs or a certain group like brachiopods or sponges. If you study the Cambrian, you've got to know it all. Oh, man. Now, a more boring group. We'll quickly go over this. Brachiopods. So during this time, we didn't have clams and other bivalves. They haven't appeared till later. Bivalves actually ripped off brachiopods in their feeding strategy. So brachiopods have two shells similar to clams, but they have a different way of filter feeding. Instead of having a tube that sucks in sediment, they have this lophophore. It's a filter feeding organ that's kind of like an arm with all these little bristles, and they would wave that around kind of like barnacles.
Oh yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. They filter feed like barnacles. And brachiopods made up most of the sessile hard-bodied organisms. So they would attach to rocks. They would attach to sponges. They would just be sitting flat on the ocean floor. They had all sorts of body shapes to prevent them from sinking into the sediment or help them anchor in to rocks and sponges. And the dead shells would have made for great anchors for sponges, as well as being recycled for more calcium in the water for trilobites to build their armor, right? So we'd get more coarse grain sand from the breaking up of these brachiopod shells over time and less fine grain sands. And then echinoderms also appeared. So the relatives of starfish and sea urchins and crinoids. The earliest crinoids, the Eocrinoidea, so dawn crinoids, appeared at this time. So they were free-floating organisms called Golgia. It kind of looks like a kite with a bunch of tendrils floating off the back. And they would have used these tendrils kind of like jellyfish arms to grab food. But this was completely armored. It had these big plates surrounding its body for protection. And eventually they would anchor to the seafloor and become modern day sea lilies we see today, filter feeding with those arms. So they appeared not that diverse though.
Interesting.
And we move on to the final group, miscellaneous and unknown. Things we have no clue what they are. Still unknown to this day. So an interesting one, this would have been a competitor to sponges. It is called Chancellara. So it looks exactly like a sponge. It is this sessile dome-shaped organism, and it's covered in spikes, but these spikes aren't the sclerites or these skeletons that would build up a sponge. They're actually plates that are on the external part of this organism. So the organism is all fleshy, and it covers itself in trident-shaped armor plating. And these little armor plates would have protected it from the worms that feed on sponges, but it doesn't have pores in its body. It can't pump water into its body and out the sides. It can only pump from the hole on the top, in and out. This is probably why this organism went extinct. It's not as efficient as sponges, where it can pump and then the water can go out in the same pump, where it has to suck in and pump back out, suck in and pump back out. So it failed to exist outside of the Cambrian. So it definitely got outcompeted by sponges. But it's interesting, we could have got an entirely different organism filling that niche, right?
They were requiring way too much energy.
Exactly. And they're very cactus-like too. We've got a very bizarre critter, which is my personal favorite. I'm a little bit biased to this guy because it's found at one of my local fossil sites. So this guy's called Bosworthia. I call it the squiggle monster. If you play Pokemon, it looks like the one called Tangela. It's this mess of like pasta-like strands, right? So whenever you find it, it kind of looks like a ball of yarn that's got unraveled. So this may have been a type of algae. All these pasta-like strands connect to a single central bulb, and it would have just flown in the water current, probably anchored down with the bulb. But it's a bizarre organism. We don't really know a lot about it yet. I want to study it a bit more for sure. The final oddball that we'll be talking about is actually a duo, a pair of organisms that we now know are kind of either symbiotic or one in the same. So Margaritia and Oesia. Originally, Margaritia is this long, tall algae-like structure, like a frond of algae, kind of like seaweed, right? And it's common. It's all over the fossil sites in Utah and all over the place in the Burgess Shale. And it obviously anchors to the seafloor. That's all that's really known about it. And there's this early worm-like organism, this hemichordate, that is found in concession with these fronds. They're kind of like inside of them. Originally, it was thought these worms may have been living like on the algae, but we now know that Margaritia is actually a tube constructed by the worm as kind of like a condo to live in. So it would have been above the seafloor, and these worms would have been just moving around in these tubes, kind of like an inverted burrow, right? It's absolutely bizarre structure, but that's what we kind of drawn the conclusion of these two critters being one in the same.
That's wild.
Yeah.
No, I can't even wrap my head around that one.
No. Yeah, there's nothing really like it today.
I know, just like, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it seems like, and even from my short understanding of the Ediacaran, it seems like most things now, other than sponges, are becoming bilaterally symmetric. Whereas from my understanding from the Ediacaran is that a lot of things were trisymmetric and then like quadrasymmetric. Their body plans were like extremely different, but this led to like this explosion had a lot of bilateral symmetry in it.
Yeah, a lot of the bilateral symmetry allows for movement in a certain direction, whereas that pentaradial, quadraradial, triad radial, or just straight up radial symmetry, it doesn't allow for a lot of direction when it comes to movement. Some of those organisms, they can go up and down or float in the water column, but they never had a reason to go anywhere, right? That's why we see the shift from that radial symmetry to the more bilateral symmetry. It allows for the greater mobility for sure.
Beautiful. When we come back from our final commercial break, we're going to be talking about the digging in the Cambrian rocks. And then we're going to get into a discussion of a little bit about evolution. And I'm pretty excited about that. So stick around.
Have you ever been standing in the shower, looking at the ingredients on your shampoo bottle, and noticed that water is always the first ingredient? Well, I have. After a little research, I discovered that shampoo is over 80% water, which is kind of like dumping bottled water on your head while you're standing in a shower. And that's why I'm excited that I found Seabar, a disposable plastic-free hair care line that cleans up ocean trash with every purchase. Not only does Seabar pick up 1 pound of ocean trash for every item ordered, but their salon-quality shampoo and conditioner concentrates come from refillable applicators, kind of like deodorant tubes. Just twist them up, rub it on over your hair a couple times, and then just lather it up like you normally would. My favorite part is how long they last. I've personally been using the same Seabar for 3 months now, and I've barely used any. So not only does it help save the environment, it's also effective, efficient, and most importantly, it saves me money. If you would like to try a better way to wash your hair, head on over to Seabar.com and use our special code STEAM for 15% off your first order. Seabar, shampoo done right for you and the planet.
This is segment 3 of the Cambrian explosion, and we're going to start off this segment talking about the paleo point of view in the Cambrian rocks. So how they go about collecting these fossils. And I'm going to give it to Brennan because he's pretty much the expert on this, at least out of the three of us. So Brennan, take it away.
Really stealing the show. Thank you. So yeah, we'll be digging into some Cambrian rocks. A lot of these sites are quite high in elevation. I've learned from experience, some of them require quite a lot of hiking and leg strength. So the Burgess Shale, for example, is about a 6-hour vertical hike. It is absolutely insane on the legs, but the views are worth it for sure. The Burgess Shale is this dense gray shale. It is very fine grains, but that also makes it a little bit harder to split because they're so compressed together. A lot of the time, the original workers of the site would use massive pickaxes, sledgehammers, and various other like very large power tools to get blocks of the exposure out. At a fossil site, a lot of the times you're looking for an exposure of rock, usually like a rock face or a cliff where you can visibly see the layers. Yeah, an outcrop of this shale. There is a scree slope usually at the bottom of this embankment. So a scree slope is all the loose shale that has come off from higher up or the face itself and tumbled down the side, forming this pile of rock. Usually paleontologists don't use that material as you lose the position of where the fossil came from, what layer it would have been in. And so that kind of information is also lost. But this is like heaven to fossil collectors because you don't need to break any rock. It's all just sitting right there for you. So scree slopes are amazing for collectors. The Burgess Shale itself is like one big scree slope. You've got this shale loosely coming off all the way down the mountain. So when you're hiking up to the site, you do a bunch of switchbacks through this sort of landslide of shale and you find all sorts of fossils in there. So that's the Burgess Shale sort of preservation. You've got this kind of high elevation exposure of rock and then a lot of loose shale down below, full and rich of this fossil material. It's also, like I mentioned, gray. So a lot of the time you'll be getting like this dark contrast with the fossil. It's kind of like a lighter gray in a sense. And then the fossil itself usually comes out as this dark black or dark gray stain on the rock. So it makes it a little easier to see the body parts. Now, gray on gray or black on gray is a little bit more difficult than what you see in China, because China has its Cambrian rock preserved in this very yellow, this fine beige sort of sediment. You get the dark fossil on a rather light background. This one's a claw from one of those big dinocarids. You can see the spike there and the gripping appendage. You can't really see it well here, but a lot of the internal workings are preserved. I've got a fossil that I got from an old collection that has a nervous system, eyeballs, and a gut tract preserved on very fine detail on this lighter rock. So the Shengzheng site in China is one of the better locations if you want to study the internal workings of these organisms. And the sediment is a lot softer, so it doesn't require big power tools to really chip away at this stuff. That is most likely due to the sediment being really, really fine, almost chalk-like, right? So that's a little bit more easier to fossil hunt at, but both the Shengzheng and the Burgess Shale are protected fossil sites. They're in national parks. Of course, they're protected because the fossils there are some of the most extraordinary and important to science. But you can do hikes out to the Burgess Shale to see the fossils on your own. I don't know about the Shengzheng. Those two are the most important because of their preservation.
So you're saying that they're all really high in elevation. There's none that are like low elevation at all. That strikes me. I mean, that makes sense, right? Because you're thinking of like the push-pull of geologic formations. It would make sense that these preservations would be the ones, you know, facing the push to go up to higher elevations. Because if not, it would have sunk back into the mantle at some point in time.
Exactly.
And there were obviously other portions of that, but they just, you know, felt the wrath of the pool, sadly.
It's so unfortunate. Yeah. And they're at the bottom of the stratigraphic map, right? They're the lowest portion of rock. So usually they got to be pushed up very high to get exposed. But there are some lower elevation ones. I think the ones in Utah are not on top of mountains. They're more like little hills in the desert. Mm. Yeah.
Okay.
The most Cambrian
I was going to say, the name of the formation is the House Range Mountains. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. So it is
mountains. So they are in mountains, but...
Yeah. Well, lower. I was referring to the U-Dig site. The formation is that?
It's House Range. And
yeah, that's also House Range.
So relative to the mountains.
Lower compared to Burgess.
Oh, yeah, true. I guess, and then compared to the water level, right?
The trilobite that Sam has, that's from the Anti-Atlas Mountains region in Morocco, which that's another high elevation mountain.
He's Ordovician, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I love how you guys can tell that. See, I'm sticking to my profession.
Oh my goodness.
What is it? That's Calamini, I think. Flexa Calamini. Yeah, yeah.
Flexi. Well,
there you go.
Aw. They're some of the most charismatic trilobites. There's a type of beauty in them for sure. I was a kid when I hunted in the house range. I haven't been back since, which is kind of unfortunate. But even as a kid, they send you out with this big sledgehammer, right? So you get a chisel, your normal everyday chisel, but you get this big little boxy sledgehammer and you gotta hit the chisel multiple times to get the shale loose. And then you pull the shale out. And then you've got to split the shale. You wedge the chisel in between a crack in the rock that's hopefully there, or split in the shale, and you eck it open, and you kind of open it like a book, and you hope there's a trilobite or something inside. And if not, you might have to whack another 20, 30, 50 rocks until you find something good. So it's all like on luck, right? Or chance. So you could be outside in the heat all day whacking and not find anything. Or find something spectacular.
The stark contrast between a heavy sledgehammer and the amount of brute force it takes to open these things, and just the fine, delicate preservation.
Oh, and sometimes that chisel slips and scrapes it up, and you're like, shoot.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you can lose some great specimens.
Is there any available technologies that can help you with just, like, say you get, like, that book of whatever sandstone, mudstone, whatever it may be, shale from your dig site? Could you then use some sort of scanning technology that gives you kind of a readout that, hey, there might be something in here because I'm getting feedback that's different from of which you would be sending a signal through, like, a regular mudstone or sandstone?
Oh,
that would be kind of cool. It would save you the effort.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's very expensive, though. It's nowhere near something like collectors can afford. But they've got this scanner that usually paleontologists put T-Rex skulls through, right? Or a skull that's half in the rock, and they want to know how much of the skull is still there. Mm-hmm. But Trevor and I were discussing this prior. They're super pricey, unfortunately. A lot of the collectors, they've got this one technique. So if you've got the book of shale, right? If you want to know something's inside of it, a lot of the time you look for a more wider gap in the shale. Most times you can see individual shale layers, but one of them will be a little bit thicker because of the organism that got preserved inside. The minerals of the organism kind of spread out inside that layer and push it apart a little bit more than usual. That's why when you whack it on the side, most of the time that layer with the fossil is the one to split opposed to any other layer, which kind of helps a bit more. If it wasn't like that and was completely random, it'd be even harder to find a fossil in the layers. But luckily, yeah, the layer with the fossil is a tad bit more loose than the rest. That's a big help.
I think it's hard to expedite the process, but if you really want to do it, instead of, like, fancy scanners and so on, you just go get, like, 200 people, bring them to the site, tell them, hey, here's a hammer, go at it.
Yeah, by numbers, sheer numbers, you'll find something.
Oof. Can't afford people to do that, though.
That segues into the last part. So the fossil site that I work with in Cranbrook is very similar to the Burgess Shale. It's got, like, the gray rock, but it's a lot more dense because it's a lower stratigraphic section of the Cambrian. It's about 513 or 15 million years old. And the rock there is so dense, you can't even work it with a normal sledge or pick. It has to be a massive pickaxe or just abysmally sized sledgehammer. The ROM team used a jackhammer and a rock saw to cut it. That's how dense the rock was. So it is really hard to work with. I'm applying for a grant to get a backhoe to dig it up, but I'm looking for volunteers, so I'm going to the local museum and saying, hey guys, I need as many people as you can supply for this. Not only is there a lot of rock to go through, it is really dense. A lot of times you do need that sheer number of people to work a site for research or for collecting. So that's kind of what I have to face.
Didn't you bring Emmett and your parents along with?
Oh, yeah. I usually, yeah, my family likes to support my outings. So I've got them to help me. But they don't last long. Yeah, they'll go out there.
You don't need to pay them.
Yeah, they'll go out there and they'll hammer away. And then they'll call it a day when they get tired. And I'm out there all day, absolutely sweating my booty off, right? But I think the incentive is you get to find fossils, right? I think that's really what draws people in. And hey, maybe I'll let the volunteers keep a specimen or two that is just a head or a body, not significant, you know, little souvenir. But I'm hoping, because I might have to rely on grant money to fund this like fully. That's the volunteer. It's a free volunteer. Yeah. It'll be fun. That's next summer.
It's the cost of being the collector. There's a lot more involved than just the exciting like aspect of just finding a fossil.
Yeah. Way more goes into it.
So the last portion we've reserved for Trevor, because this is a very interesting topic that I want to hear his take on. So Trevor, do you want to talk about contingency versus determinism?
Sure. Okay.
Polarizing.
Yeah. So one of the big takeaways with the Cambrian period is that it shows life's first experimentation with complex life. You saw all those bizarre and crazy organisms that Brennan talked about. And it really, when you put it all together, it looks like a really alien planet, sort of prehistoric ocean. The emergence of so many forms so quickly has sometimes been challenged. People will occasionally even go so far as to say, like, oh, this disproves evolution because you've got this wide diversity of life emerging from seemingly nothing. And over the course of many years of just research and collecting and documenting and studying sites, we've been able to backfill. And that's where we've been able to study and find out about the Ediacaran organisms that preceded the Cambrians and the slow, steady pace that evolution has taken. So the Cambrian offers a very unique and brief window into the origin of multicellular life. If you're philosophical, you can start to get into the question of what would happen if life had proceeded slightly differently. The paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould very famously said, if you were to wind back time and let life play out again, random occurrences would cause drastically different changes that would affect the final outcome. This is summarizing the contingency versus determinism debate. Contingency is one side that argues that outcomes are sensitive to seemingly inconsequential events that can fundamentally change the future. So like anything, like some random event, like for example, an asteroid hitting the Earth caused a tremendously different future that led to the rise of mammals. Had the asteroid not hit the Earth, you, maybe there would still be dinosaurs around. I mean, non-avian. Yeah. Whereas the other side of the debate is determinism, which says that lineages under pressure will always kind of converge on the same phenotype. So maybe the steps are a little different, but you'll always kind of arrive at something that kind of resembles an intelligent human apes sort of thing. No matter how many random things happen, you always kind of end up towards the same outcome. Determinism has sometimes been conflated with what's called judgment of worth, where the ideology kind of has grown out of the idea that humans are in a superior placement to the rest of the animal kingdom, that no matter how many crazy occurrences happen in history, you're always going to end up with something that is similar to humans in outcome. And many paleontologists, with Stephen Gould in particular being one of the main voices in favor of it, he argues that we need to step back, be a little bit more modest in our views of ourselves, and realize that we're just the product of a random process. That evolution is just, it's mutation, recombination, natural selection, and genetic drift. And that any series of random events could have produced a wildly different outcome for the future of Earth. And when you look at the Cambrian, had anything differently happened in these early stages of life, we could have seen vastly different outcomes for what life could have ended up as. Let's say if the early chordates were to go extinct, who knows what could have possibly evolved from that? you wouldn't get tetrapods. You'd get something wildly different. Maybe the arthropods would have become dominant on the planet. It really gets to, this is a little sappy, but for the Darwin quote, from so simple a beginning, endless forms are most beautiful and wonderful, have been and are constantly evolving. It really gets towards our placement in the vast span of life, and our understanding of ourselves is greatly influenced by our study of the small things, insignificant things like the Cambrian period.
I also want to add to that, because if you look at it on a statistical standpoint, you think about the only time that we have seen or witnessed anything as being fictional is Homo sapiens. And that only occurred, with our best understanding, 70, 60,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. Statistically speaking, with all of the species that have been on Earth from the Cambrian explosion to today, have not needed such a mutation. That is literally a like 0.0000 some percent chance that you need fiction. You do not need fiction, the ability to take in information, store it, and then predict what's going to happen, you know, to you. That's pretty much fiction. Nowhere else is that needed to survive, to be an apex predator, to be something that survives. Sharks don't need it. They've been here through all five mass extinctions. Same with the horseshoe crab. I mean, there's so many species that have not needed that and have been extremely successful. For example, the trilobites, 23,000 species, over 200 million years. Homo sapiens have been here for 200,000. From my standpoint, it comes from a lack of understanding and a lot of egotism. Right. That's my overarching opinion. Yeah, wind the clock back. It could be so different in so many ways. You could wind the clock back 8 million years ago and Homo sapiens might not be here. It could be that, like, let's say the Neanderthals somehow, even with their big bone structures and their large brains, became capable of housing such abilities of fictionizing. There's no way of knowing that. It's like the parallel universe theory. You can't grab intrinsic data to make such claim. Outside of that, it's extremely outlandish.
Yeah. Any random event could produce such a crazily different outcome. When hominins are first evolving, something as simple as like just a single volcano going off, that could have wiped us out. Or the Ice Age, right? It had just like one glacier gone further south and caused who knows what. You get a butterfly effect of just like, oh, this causes this. And now who knows what species is around and what goes extinct.
Yeah, this convergence stuff, you know, might be something based on our interpretation through our lens of things, but most of it is based on genetic mutation, randomness, and environmental pressures. That's truly it. And that's honestly, that's beautiful enough. We don't need to add to it. I think it's way more cool to have like randomness or you know, a chaos theory to how things evolve. I think that's way better. Better explanation. Sorry, Brennan, you've been extremely silent. What do you got?
No, I love listening to it. You guys, this is like mind-blowing. You're going to a new level of thought here. It's incredible. It's like we are so insignificant in the grand scheme of things because we're living at the current, right? Well, everything that happens now determines the future, and the future is not written yet. Anything can appear. Anything could happen, right? But like you said, taking yourself back to a point in time and changing anything, like a disease spreading, or like Trevor said, a glacier moving too far, you see greatly different things. And I think there's a lot of fun in that, the randomness of what could have been, right? Or the kind of wonder of what's out there that we haven't found yet, right? I think that definitely plays a big part into science itself.
It could be a cosmic event. It could be a geologic event. It could be a virus. It could be an overarching bacteria. It could be just so many different things, which is awesome. I mean, okay, I do say it is cool that we have the ability to create fiction to say, wow, what could it have been?
Yeah.
Let's picture that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, fiction just isn't necessary. But it's here, and we're living it. I love it. Well, guys, do you have anything else that you want to say before we wrap things up? We've been at this for a long time.
Oh, I think we summarized everything pretty well.
I agree.
Yeah, I think we covered everything.
Yep, fit it all.
Well, we covered everything for a podcast.
Yeah.
This is research paper.
Brandon, pull out your cards. Let's go for the next couple hours.
No.
every single team ring creature.
Yeah, I've got 70 here. Let's go.
But just as a quick synopsis before we run out of here, in way overarching, I can't begin to summarize everything like I want to, but the Cambrian explosion is, of course, a random event that happened through environmental triggers that is such a small, significant, but also insignificant amount of time in the overarching time frame, the geologic time frame of Earth. 4.5 billion years. What's happening here is 50 to 60 million, and it brought rise to the vertebrates, which ended up somehow coming to us somehow. It's beautiful. There's a lot of amazing things to be studied, and there's just so much beauty in it. The niches, the creatures that were there, what died out, what stayed, and what led up to it, which is really cool. So not really a rise and fall of soft bodies, but like what it could have been if, you know, certain things. And contingency versus determinism is something that is unfortunately still widely debated, but but guys, I really appreciate you being on the podcast. This has been great. Brandon, it's been awesome just getting to talk to you a little bit more. And Trevor, has always been fun. Aww. Thank you to the both of you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And yeah. I'll have you again soon.
Yeah. So excited for that. Oh my goodness.
That is all for this episode of Everything STEAM. I just wanted to take a quick second and thank Trevor and Brennan for taking their time to share their knowledge about the Cambrian explosion. If you love paleontology, fun facts, and cool fossils, I recommend you give Trevor and Brennan a follow like I did on Instagram. The links to do so will be on our website, everythingsteam.org. Just head to the episodes tab, click on the episodes page, and there you will find what you're after. I would also love to mention my amazing team for their collective efforts to make the show happen. This podcast was edited by Ariel Piermont, marketed by Courtney Page, QC by Panyapit Eriksit, and our episode art was manifested by Gabrielle Edmiston. After the episode, give our podcast a rating and review on whatever platform you get your podcasts on. We're always looking for feedback, and the rating would greatly help us out in the fight against the algorithms. Lastly, be sure to check us out on all the socials for podcast news, upcoming episodes, and fun STEAM content. Just search Everything STEAM on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and Reddit to join in on that fun. Once again, thank you for listening to Everything STEAM. I am your host, Sam Stanford, and as always, stay curious.
Everything STEAM would like to give a shout out to Anchor by Spotify for sponsoring our podcast along with Ben Sound Music for providing our show with intro, outro, and advertisement background rhythm.